Today is Monday, July 25th, 2011. I'm Iqbal Ahmed.
And I'm Martin Lumlin. This is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening, it's 5:04, time for a full hour of News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news.
First on CITR's News 101, we go to international headlines on Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. EU leaders held an emergency meeting today and put forward a draft agreement to rescue debt-stricken Greece and to prevent other nations from being threatened by the crisis. FSRN's Cinnamon Nepard has more from Berlin.
Greece has been teetering on the edge of financial collapse for months, and attempts by the government to cut spending have been met with widespread, sometimes violent, protests. The EU has been working with the country on a solution, fearing the effect a total economic collapse would have on the rest of the continent. After weeks of disagreement, France and Germany agreed Wednesday night on a common position. Today, Eurozone leaders released a draft agreement proposing lower interest rates for Greece and lengthening the maturity of loans from 7.5 years to 15 years. Officials also said they were willing to offer the country a second set of emergency loans. The draft agreement also proposes to increase the flexibility of the European Financial Stability Facility, which is the fund set up by Eurozone countries to deal with the financial crises in the region. Cinnamon Nippard, FSRN, Germany.
As many as a dozen people are dead today after protesters and police clashed in Malawi. Yesterday, riots broke out with YouTube videos showing many protesters wearing red shirts, hats, and bandanas. The demonstrators, largely from poor townships, are angry about the rising cost of living and the current government. BNO News reports that around 40 protest leaders have been arrested. Last night, the National Labor Court of Israel issued an injunction against striking doctors, ordering them back to work. Yesterday, several hundred state-employed medical professionals at hospitals all across Israel walked out. They're angry because their calls for better pay, staffing, and hours have not been met in the most recent round of contract negotiations. Today, several dozen doctors ignored the labor court order and began a hunger strike, according to Israeli media. Others sought medical attention for exhaustion in one hospital's emergency room. The Treasury and the Israeli Medical Association are slated for another round of negotiations within the next day. Today, dozens of Palestinian refugees in the Gaza Strip stepped up protests against the UN Relief and Works Agency. They say the International Aid Group, which serves about 1 million refugees in Gaza, intends to change its mandate and reduce services. FSRN's Rami Almagari reports.
On Thursday morning, a group of Gaza refugees held a sit-in outside the premises of UNRWA's Gaza field office. They prevented agency staff from entering the building. Protesters say the UNRWA is planning to reduce various services offered to the refugee population in the territory, including health, social, educational, and sanitation. They cite a recent cut-off of food rations to several thousand Gaza refugees as an indication of more cuts to come. UNRWA's spokesperson, Chris Guinness, says the agency is facing a budget shortfall of about $35 million. Guinness told Afasaran that they are changing the way they distribute food in the territory.
Anyone who thinks that they are improving the situation for refugees by preventing UNRWA from doing its job is living on another planet. I mean, it is very counterproductive.
The problem began several weeks ago when the agency dropped the words Relief and Works from its name. Since then, refugees in Gaza have voiced concern the agency's mandate would also be changed. UNRWA has denied the allegation. Rami Al-Mighari, Afasaran, Gaza.
Landing gear down and locked.
Space Shuttle Atlantis made its final landing this morning at Kennedy Space Center in Florida. It was the final flight of NASA's storied shuttle program, which lasted longer than four decades. The landing, as called by the NASA Mission Control announcer.
Nose gear touchdown. Having fired the imagination of a generation, a ship like no other, its place in history secured, the space shuttle pulls into port for the last time. Its voyage at an end.
Currently, NASA's future is more insecure than it's ever been, with lawmakers dealing with a huge deficit eyeing its funding. But NASA seems to recognize its insecure position. What's next is a prominent feature on its website. In an early July speech at the National Press Club, NASA Administrator Charles Bolden said they are looking to the future.
President Obama has given us a mission with a capital M to focus again on the big picture of exploration and the crucial research and development that will be required for us to move beyond low Earth orbit. He's charged us with carrying out the inspiring missions that only NASA can do, which will take us farther than we've ever been to orbit Mars and eventually land on it.
NASA says it's focusing on four areas: exploration, science, aeronautics, and the International Space Station. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at FSRN.org. I'm Martin Lemlin.
And I'm Iqbal Ahmed. Now it's time for your News 101 headlines. In campus news, the UBC Whistler Lodge is facing heavy financial losses, forcing the Alma Mater Society to rethink the lodge's role and the marketing of the facility. The lodge, which charges $29 per night to UBC students, contributed approximately $30,000 to the student society's debts this year. AMS President Jeremy McElroy attributes this to lower-than-anticipated booking during the school year and poor marketing. The lodge is also in need of repairs to the roof and pipes. An external consultant has been hired to help the AMS accurately gauge the cost of necessary repairs. As McElroy said in reference to the lodge's possible closure, quote, "It's one of the options on the table. It's something that we like. Students built it, and it's part of a tradition for UBC for a better part of 50 years. We don't really want to shut it down," end quote.
National New Democratic leader Jack Layton announced today that he will be temporarily stepping down from his leadership position due to health concerns. Layton, who led his party to an historic victory in the spring, had previously battled prostate cancer, and this time did not state what part of his body this new cancer was affecting, but only that he noticed it in the final days of the parliamentary sessions. He hopes to return to politics on September 19th, when the House is set to reopen. Layton recommended Hall Elmer MP Nicole Turmel as interim leader, in a move likely intended to stave off an internal leadership battle and demonstrate his intended return. Layton says that he's hopeful and optimistic about the personal battle that lies before him in the weeks to come.
In local news, the second annual North American Out Games kicked off today in Vancouver, as did Pride Week. The Out Games, hosted by Gay and Lesbian International Sports and Human Rights Association, or GLISA for short, are self-styled as a sports event, human rights conference, and cultural and community celebration. Sports events range in diversity from dance and soccer to more creative entries such as Texas Hold'em and Eco Challenge Mountain Race, while conference topics include HIV prevention and the transgender community, engaging aging athletes, and notions of gender in the classroom. It is expected that the overlap of the Out Games with Out Week will see a large influx of visitors to the city, especially in advance of Sunday's Pride Parade. Vancouver Elk Games President John Boychuk emphasized that the event is open and welcome to everyone, including heterosexuals, saying, quote, "Inclusive, friendly sports within our community breaks down barriers and builds on the foundation of equality through sports and community outreach. Friends, families, allies, and sponsors are all welcome to be part of the grassroots events that will see the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, transsexual, queer, questioning, two-spirited, and intersex community come out," end quote. Be sure to catch CITR live coverage of the Out Games continuing today at 7 p.m.
In local news, a new affordable housing building in the downtown east side is the first of 14 such buildings that were promised in 2007 to be opened. The Sorella Complex, which is at the corner of Abbott and Pender Streets, is home to 108 units specifically designed for those considered to be vulnerable. Provincial Housing Minister Rich Coleman said the Sorella Complex is more than just housing. It will help women regain confidence and their independence. Six more of the promised buildings are slated for completion this year, built with a combination of city, province, and federal funding. At the opening of the building, Federal Heritage Minister Jason Moore announced a funding agreement between the federal and provincial governments in which the province chooses how best to spend federal funding designated for housing. The joint funding of $180 million announced was part of the $1.9 billion commitment that the federal government promised in 2008 to help address the needs of low-income British Columbians.
And Abbotsford Teed is dead after a weekend hit and run early Saturday morning. 17-year-old Desmond Bossy was a recent graduate of W.J. Mount Secondary who was headed to Simon Fidge University on a football scholarship in the fall. He was killed in a hit-and-run collision when he was walking home from a birthday party less than a mile away from his home. The passenger in the vehicle came forward to the police with information, and the 17-year-old driver turned himself in shortly afterwards. Criminal charges are being considered, and the RCMP have taken over the investigation after it was revealed that one of the individuals involved was the extended family member of a member of the Abbotsford Police Force. Both names have been withheld to protect the identity of the underage individuals.
We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold, but the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
Just fucking use you. You know what I'm saying, Joe?
What is that? What is it? One more shot? A salute?
Tune in to Sore Throats and Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet, Monday evenings at 6:30 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And in the end.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And now, in the spirit of the start of the Out Games and Pride Week, we're going to bring you another FSRN segment about hundreds of same-sex couples exchanging vows in New York after the passage of the Marriage Equality Act.
Yesterday was a historic day in New York State after hundreds of same-sex couples were legally married. In New York City, crowds formed long lines in the very early morning outside the city clerk's offices. Salim Rizvi reports.
A festive atmosphere filled the streets outside the city clerk's office in downtown Manhattan on Sunday, where hundreds of same-sex couples waited for their turn to say, "I do," while their families, friends, and supporters cheered the newlyweds. Inside the city clerk's office, couples were granted their marriage licenses, and with a waiver for the 24-hour waiting period, they were able to exchange vows moments later. One couple, Colleen and Leah Opinzato, took their vows in front of Judge Neil Ross.
"As an institution born of love and devotion, marriage is the deliberate and lasting joining of desires, dreams, and aspirations between two people. Leah, do you take Colleen for your wife, and do you promise to be true to her in good times and in bad, in sickness and in health, to love her and honor her all the days of your life?"
"I do."
"It is my true pleasure to present Leah and Colleen, equal partners, united in sacred matrimony. Congratulations."
"Thank you."
Thank you.
Colleen Pinzato said she looks forward to married life together.
Everyone wants to find someone who, you know, they can grow old with, and that's just what we want too. And I think more and more people are coming to see that it's as simple as that.
Many same-sex couples waited for this day for years to legally exchange vows and receive the same rights and protections as heterosexual couples. One newly married couple, Damien Ross and Gary Casgrove, have been together for 15 years.
We just got married this afternoon a little while ago, and we just couldn't tell you how incredible it feels. You know, you when you see people getting married on any day of the week, you're like, all right, congratulations. But until it's yours, you have no idea. There's no stronger thing than be able to declare that this is our family.
It's symbolic for us and our family. It's symbolic for the community.
More than 650 same-sex couples received marriage licenses in New York City, and 484 were married at city marriage bureaus on Sunday. Hundreds more are expected to follow, marking the beginning of a new social era in New York after Governor Andrew Cuomo signed the Marriage Equality Bill into law on June 24th. The new law now gives gay couples the same rights as heterosexual couples. David Munoz, who married his partner, Jose Munoz, on Sunday, said their lives will be easier now that they have legal protections.
Well, there's so many problems. You can look at taxation. You can look at insurance. You can look at health benefits. You can say, if one of us gets ill, banking. We can't even open a bank account in which something happens to the other where the funds would go over. Inheritance taxes. There's so many things that we are limited by not being able to get married. Now we can be a part of that.
New York is one of six states in the United States to allow same-sex marriage. Newlyweds and their supporters say they'll continue the fight for equal rights, focusing now on the federal level and the repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act. Salim Rizvi, FSR in New York City.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you again to FSN for bringing us those headlines. And as we said before, the full newscast and headlines can be found at FSRN.org. And now we're going to begin a short panel discussion with me, Iqbal Ahmed, and my co-host Martin Lemlin about the recent shooting in Norway, and maybe discuss the implications it has on the way people see terrorism, especially in a post-9/11 world.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was fairly recent, happened on Friday, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as far as shootings go, it was pretty massive.
Mm-hmm.
I believe
the original number was about 92 people killed.
I think it's up to 96 now, with additional 93 injured.
They've actually revised it down to 73.
All right. Mm-hmm.
So they've actually kind of recalled the number, I think, because people were in the hospital and there were some people killed in such a small area,
yeah,
finding bodies and things of that sort.
In any case, at the hands of one man, and mm-hmm. the casualty list is massive.
Yes, of course. I think one thing that kind of caught a lot of people, especially in the media, by surprise was that when this happened, everyone immediately thought Muslim terrorism. I think maybe it was last year that they stopped a cell that was in Sweden. I thought this might be an offshoot of that because Scandinavia is known for large Muslim populations coming in, large Muslim immigrants, and kind of what was happening in England, which is like homegrown Muslim terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
I think people's minds automatically jumped to that, but it appears it's actually the exact opposite.
Fundamentalist Christian.
Mm-hmm, fundamentalist right-wing Christian who claims to have done these attacks in response to the rising tide of Muslims in Europe, what he calls, you know, Eurabia, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
I believe his hearing was yesterday,
yeah,
or today, and he wanted an open kind of forum for him to say why he did the things. I think his line was that they were discussing, but they were necessary. And
obviously declined.
Yeah, obviously the judge did not let him, you know, use the court as a podium to,
yeah,
spout whatever ideology he has. And
there's also this 1,500-page manifesto that he apparently penned.
Yeah, 1,500-page, and one report I was reading was saying that there were a lot of lines taken exactly from Ted Kaczynski's manifesto, the Unabomber in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
And apparently he just changed some words because Ted Kaczynski was very much...
technology.
Yeah, technology and leftist.
Yeah.
And he changed the words technology and leftist to multiculturalism, to immigration, to the rising Muslim tide. But he did keep a lot of the things about feminism that Ted Kaczynski railed about.
Oh, yeah?
So there's some like paragraphs that are copy and paste from Ted Kaczynski's manifesto.
And others that are just slightly altered.
Mm-hmm, slightly altered. And I believe there's been conflicting reports that he's been giving. First he said he acted alone. Now he's saying there's other cells in other European countries who are going to act in the same way. And although I think the police aren't really taking... I mean, they're obviously taking everything he says very seriously and mm-hmm. checking them out, but I feel like the theory is that he did act alone. Just mm-hmm. in the way this was conducted was kind of a lone wolf sort of thing. And there was one Swedish researcher I was actually kind of interested in. He was talking about how these sort of mass killings outside of maybe organized terrorism, such as that we see with groups like Al-Qaeda, is that these people, they see themselves, they're very narcissistic.
Yeah.
Like, apparently, a lot of what he talks about is his own place in history and how he's going to change the world with what he did, kind of feeding his own ego for what he did. But I think more interesting about this case is that what it speaks to the current state in Europe is that I feel kind of the rising anti-immigrant sentiments, that this is obviously an extreme form of, but in countries like England and Finland, in Austria, in even Holland, the country that's generally been known for its openness mm-hmm. in recent years, there has been this pushback against the rising number of Muslim immigrants. I know in Finland, Austria, and Holland especially, there have been right-wing parties elected to their parliaments and into their government, and kind of shows that there is this organized...
A little bit of animosity towards the influx.
Because mm-hmm. I think, you know, this shooter, a lot of his stuff was about the decline of the European culture, like what makes Europe is being taken over by Arabs and Muslims and people, I mean, North Africans and Middle East. So,
well, that's being changed sort of everywhere around the world, not mm-hmm. only with, you know, Muslims going into Europe, but I mean, the internet and stuff. Culturalism in general is starting to become a little bit homogenized.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of these cultures, or a lot of these groups, you know, in these kind of more right-wing groups are kind of holding on to this kind of ideal of what European culture is without thinking of how much European culture has changed, maybe even in the last 200 years. I mean, there's people who say, you know, Europe is this long tradition of, you know, this like homogenous culture. Well, I mean, that's obviously not true. Maybe a bit more to an extent in Scandinavia, where they were a bit more isolated, you know, further up north, further away. But, I mean, if you look at Spain, the Moors, Muslims were in Spain for over 200 years.
Yeah.
Muslims, you know, the Mongols came pretty much all the way up to Europe. A lot of invading armies have come into Europe and changed the culture in Europe, so...
It's not necessarily a bad thing to want to cling to those traditions, but obviously this is ridiculous. Uh-huh. The interesting thing about it now is that they've captured him alive,
mm-hmm.
and they have, obviously this is going to be an opinion, and sorry for it, but an obvious nut on their case,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to try him fairly, and it's going to be an interesting process to keep an eye on, for sure.
I think this will definitely be a trial on the kind of Norwegian legal system as well.
Yeah.
They're dealing with something that they, at least to my knowledge, haven't dealt with in a long time, or ever even. Mm. I mean, this was the biggest act of violence in Norway since World War II.
Yeah.
And there's some, I was reading one report about how the maximum sentence generally in Norway for crime is about 21 years. And there are avenues by which this can be changed, you know, repeated offenders, but just this, I guess the Norwegian culture that they've, the way the legal system has been structured
mm-hmm.
isn't made to
imprison people for
life forever.
For large lengths of time.
Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, if this happened in the United States, which they have had...
They can give them consecutive life sentences.
Consecutive life sentences and, you know, spend the rest of their lives in jail. But I think this will be a trial for kind of Norwegian openness in one sense.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that the culture is naive or anything like that. That's not what I'm trying to say. I'm just trying to say that... this hasn't been something they've had to deal with in the past.
Yes, and I mean, considering how heinous the crime was, mm-hmm. it's surprising that people aren't screaming for blood to uh-huh. begin with, and they're actually going to give them a fair trial.
Uh-huh. As you kind of see in places like the United States, I think But only time will tell how this affects the Norwegian mentality. I mean, how much 9/11 affected the way the United States sees the rest of the world.
Yeah.
I mean, will this lead to Norway maybe becoming a bit more conservative in the way they deal with things, maybe more with the United States, a bit more? Will this make them rethink the rise of the right in these countries? Will it make places like Austria and Finland and Holland rethink where this is heading?
Or extremism in general, who does it and why they do it.
Okay, well, I think that's been a very productive panel talk. We're going to take another quick break. This is CITR 101.9 FM from Broadcasting University of British Columbia in Vancouver. We'll be right back.
Now, the electric prunes for Vox, bringing you the exciting new sound of the Vox Wah-Wah pedal. Let the electric prunes demonstrate the difference. Play it prunes first without the Wah-Wah pedal. Now, listen to the difference when you push that Vox Wah-Wah pedal down. You can even make your guitar sound like a sitar. It's the now sound. It's what's happening. That's why the Electric Prunes, Animals, Herman's Hermits, Paul Revere and the Raiders, Stones, the Seeds, are all using the Vox Wah-Wah pedal, and it works with any amplifier. If you're a professional musician or want to sound like one, get with the new Vox Wah-Wah pedal at your Vox dealer now.
As demonstrated on Rumbletone Radio Agogo, third Wednesdays from 3 till 5 p.m. here on CITR.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will net you discounts downtown at 212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, Heart and Soul Clothing Incorporated, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinema Tech, Scratch Records, True Value Vintage, Vinyl Records, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or visit us online at citr.ca.
Welcome back to CITR News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. I'll go throwing over things to Iqbal here.
Well, thank you, Martin. We're joined in the studio right now with Ellen Tyer, the VP Finance for the AMS, and we're going to be talking about the preliminary budget, which was just released.
The final budget, actually.
Oh, is it the final budget now? Okay, well, can you just tell us some of the highlights of this budget, things that people should know?
Sure. So it was an interesting budgeting season this year. It's definitely nothing ordinary. We had a lot of things come from left field, which is why it was kind of delayed. But the main, I guess the major differences are we're now budgeting for a bigger contingency, just looking at our risk factors in the events department and some of the other areas. We're definitely the committee took a more realistic approach to budgeting, and so we feel that everything we've done is not on based on what it should be, but really on what our realistic expectations are. Our contributions from our businesses are struggling. Administration costs are going up, and we're projecting a $163,000 deficit. So the major kind of highlights there, but we're confident that this is kind of the worst case scenario, and we'll be in a much healthier financial position in the coming years.
Yeah, it does seem like you guys have kind of prepared for the worst in the coming year and been a very conservative budget.
Definitely.
With how much business can contribute. And you guys have also factored expected loss from first week in the Welcome Back barbecues.
Yep. So we usually do that, actually. We don't try to make too much money off of our events. We try to, as much as we can, break even. But we are factoring in costs there for first week and Welcome Back. We're hoping that Block Party is a net zero kind of breaks even. But, yeah.
Have these events ever been profitable? Or is this kind of a recent thing that you have to account for?
No, they haven't.
Really?
Historically, we don't charge cover tickets for Welcome Back Barbecue and Block Party. Really is only 3 years old, and I think we did decent in the first year, 2008, I remember, with when the Roots were here. but we lost a lot of money the years after. And this past year, we made a huge improvement compared to other years. So financially speaking, it was a lot less of a drag on our money. But yeah, we're hoping that we can improve on our events, programming, and all that.
And I think one thing that interests a lot of people is how the recent referendum has affected the budget. And even with this conservative budget, with the larger deficit, would it have been a lot worse if we didn't have the referendum?
Yeah, so people, I guess, were expecting a lot of new things, new funding for different areas. But yeah, without the referendum, we'd be over $500,000 in deficit, and we'd go broke in a year. So definitely helped us out. We definitely needed that to survive. If it hadn't survived, then we would have had to cut a significant portion of our functions and on our team. And
Well, thank God it passed then. But another thing I've heard is how the increase in the minimum wage has really affected how this budget was constructed, and that probably even affects the revenues that you expect from AMS businesses. Can you kind of speak to?
It does. Our budget for business revenues last year was $900,000. We came quite a bit short at 611, I think, last year. And we're projecting for a $497,000, so almost $500,000, quite a bit less than what it was. And a portion of that is the minimum wage. The big part, the big increase in our costs is actually our change management, where we're doing a whole reorganization in our organization to get ready for the new sub, and all of our focus is just looking in the long term, in the next 3 to 5 years, into the new sub. So a lot of the planning for the budgets, and budgeting for that matter, is based on that kind of 3-year outlook. And we're actually hoping to come back in September, October with a 3-year budget, kind of a rough outline on how we're going to move forward. So yeah, those we did increase our minimum wages. We actually started paying wages in 2008 when we found out that honorarium, the practice that we were using for honorarium, wasn't necessarily legal. But since then, it's been an issue. It was a huge cost then. And we increased it this year, not only to the new minimum wage level, but to a little bit above that, to what we thought was a more fair compensation for our students, student staff. And so we're kind of proud of that. And obviously, that comes with its challenges, and we're looking to control costs other places.
Do you foresee business revenue picking up once the new sub is created?
Definitely. And that's definitely most of our energy is going towards that in the new businesses in there. And that's a reason why we're kind of doing a little, we're not making too many improvements here, because we're focusing all of our energy, and we'll see a dramatic rise in our revenues once we get there.
Okay. Another kind of hole that's people point to in the budget, just kind of a money pit, is the Whistler Lodge.
Yeah.
And can you kind of speak to that?
I was there this weekend, actually. Sure. So it's been an interesting... We discovered last year that even though it reported profits, it actually wasn't... it was losing about $100,000 a year. It was just using other funds elsewhere in our fund, complicated, complex... budget. And so it's been losing money for a while now, and last year it was a huge, it was $80,000 below budget, so we lost quite a bit. And this year we're expecting to lose more money from that. So it's not very sustainable in the long term, and we are addressing that. We've just council approved, I think last month, funding for consultants. So we're working together with a development expert on looking at the market there and the business case going forward. And also we'll be doing a lot of consultations with student groups and students in general and counselors on what we want to see there. Do we want to keep losing money? Do we want to go for a profit-making model, or do we want to sell the lodge? Do we want to make it a break even? So these are all like philosophical, I guess, questions that need to be looked at. But we're looking at our options. We're looking at the market realities right now, doing mm-hmm. a study of that, and then we'll move forward given our options and in a new direction, hopefully something that's more sustainable financially, mm-hmm. something that can stand on its own.
All right, well, I guess besides the budget, while we have you here, a lot of people have been, kind of a lot of chatter amongst UBC students has been the new UPass next year. Mm-hmm. Could you just kind of give a brief rundown about that?
Sure, it's not an area of my expertise, we're the costs are increasing to $30, and mm-hmm. that was part of the referendum that passed. So every 3 years, we have to go back and ask students if they want to maintain it, and they said yes. The costs are increasing to $30 a month, and it's going to switch to a monthly bus mm-hmm. pass. So every month, you're going to have to go to the bookstore. They're going to have these machines where you put in your student card and you get your bus pass. So you have a couple weeks to do that mm-hmm. every month. And yeah, so it's not going to be a 4 month pass. And mm-hmm.
Is this new system temporary? I mean, I'm not sure if you can really speak to this, but
I think they're looking at a transition to a more of a scanning mm-hmm. thingy that would be integrated into your student card. That's quite in the long term.
Yeah.
For the next few years, it's gonna be this way. I think. I don't think TransLink is gonna forgo the current investments that mm-hmm. they're making into all these vending machine thingies that give out bus passes. So, yeah.
All right. Well, great. Well, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, no worries. My pleasure.
Is there anything else you want to let our listeners know about the budget? Any
budget? Yeah.
Use your podium. So.
I guess one challenge was that I didn't mention before was the tax, and we're looking at issues. I think there's a concern across Canada with student unions that CRA is starting to target us and mm-hmm. Charge us taxes. So that's something that we're looking to hopefully address this year and go forward.
Do you currently not pay taxes to the MSS?
So we're a nonprofit society. So as a result of that, we don't get charged business mm-hmm. taxes because we spend all of our revenues on student services and just anything to do with students. But they're looking at changing that and charging us business tax, which will affect about us. It'll be about $80,000 to $100,000 mm-hmm. This year, so it's quite considerable.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, a concern for myself. And
is that what the contingency part of the budget is kind of focused towards?
No, we actually have a business tax contingency that's separate from that.
Okay.
This, so we're budgeting for it. We're hoping that we can come to some kind of a an agreement or understanding mm-hmm. with the CRA on that.
Have they taken away the nonprofit status of other student unions in Canada so far?
No, it's just an issue that started this year, so they're mm-hmm. looking at a couple other schools, I believe, and yeah, it's just a national kind of strategy for them, but we're looking to fight back and maintain our nonprofit status and not mm-hmm. Pay taxes so that we can do more student programming and student services.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, great. Well, thank you, Ellen, for joining us today. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Stay tuned.
Are you interested in radio but not quite sure how to get involved? CITR is the place for you. We are a volunteer-driven campus and community radio station with a variety of volunteer opportunities. Want to become an on-air programmer? Learn about promotions? Maybe become a news or arts reporter? Come learn about all the ways you can become involved at CITR. Volunteer orientations are held on the first Monday of every month at 6:30 p.m. If the first Monday falls on a statutory holiday, the orientation moves to the second Monday. Visit citr.ca for more information.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the Helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the Helpline is one of the many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The Helpline number is 604-696-4666. Or contact us at aidsvancouver.org.
Welcome back to CITR News 101. It's now time for In the Elements. We're joined by Scott Douglas. Scott, you're there?
Good afternoon.
How are you?
I'm not entirely unwell. Thank you very much for asking.
That's as good as it gets with you, I think.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. So I'm gonna jump straight into the weather because there's a lot of it, an unusual amount of it this week, actually.
More than 24 hours?
What's that there?
More than 24 hours worth on a daily basis?
There's gonna be just enough.
Just enough, all right.
But it's still too much. You'll see. Today, it's obviously, I mean, look outside. It's grayish. Splashes of sunshine. We should look for the same overnight without the sunshine. It will just be gray, not on this continent. An overnight low tonight of 14 degrees. So I guess if I was my mom, I would be telling me not to leave the house with anything less than like a sweater and maybe even a jacket tonight.
Wise words, wise words.
Right? Because you don't want to defy that. Tomorrow, we are due for some rain. A daytime high of 18 degrees Celsius means you'll be able to wear what you normally would and also carry an umbrella. Or you could go the extremist route and bundle all the way up in your rain gear so you don't get any water on your elaborate hairdo. We're looking at an overnight low, Tuesday night, of 13 degrees. Wednesday, the hump day, we'll be back to mixed clouds and sunshine with a daytime high of 19 degrees. So it'll be cloudy, but not cool. Back to sweater weather. I hope you've got enough. Did you do laundry this weekend?
Actually, I just did, yes.
Beauty. You're set then, sir. Everyone else is probably biting their fingernails now because they're thinking, you know, who does laundry on the weekend? Okay, Thursday. Another one of these days I look forward to because it's going to be exactly room temperature, no rain. So you can dress the way you would if you were just going to stay inside all day. So I figure you bust out like the silk kimono.
Oh, yes, yes.
If it's windy, you know, cinch it up around waist level. But other than that, you know, you're good to go. An overnight temperature of about 13 degrees that night. So maybe some slippers also. Friday and Saturday, I'm pleased and elated to announce, will be lovely sunny days. 20 degrees, sparse cloud cover. So get yourself some sunscreen and enjoy the gorgeous weather this weekend.
Beautiful. It's prime for street hockey.
It is prime for street hockey. Tiebreaker this weekend, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe so.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you before then, sir.
Yes.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Scott. And that was Scott Douglas bringing us his weekday weather wizardry. On a slightly more somber note, we're going to throw things back to FSRN now with a report that they put together regarding the increasing struggle to produce food in Somalia for the catastrophe that's brewing up over there.
Officials with the Food and Agriculture Organization are meeting in Rome today to discuss the crisis in Somalia. Last week, the United Nations declared famine in two regions there, estimating that tens of thousands have already died and 12 million people are at risk of starvation. Some emergency supplies are starting to enter the country and neighbouring Kenya, where many are fleeing. UN Radio's Nikki Chadwick reports.
The World Food Programme will begin airlifting food supplies into Mogadishu over the next few days, and it'll supply food and blankets to 175,000 people in an area along the border with Kenya and Ethiopia. Emilia Casella is a spokesperson for the World Food Programme.
We will be concentrating on bringing in ready-to-use therapeutic and supplementary foods aimed to help the most malnourished children, and those will begin in the coming days. As part of our efforts in Mogadishu, wet feeding is taking place in 16 centres around the city. Each is providing food to more than 5,000 people each day. These are hot meals. So we're reaching about 85,000 people.
The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says that each day around 1,000 people arrive in Mogadishu after fleeing famine-stricken regions in the south. Melissa Fleming, spokesperson for UNHCR, says that thousands more are making the life-threatening decision to leave their country.
We are really trying our best to work inside Somalia so that people don't have to make this devastating trek into Kenya and Ethiopia.
In Kenya's Dadaab camps, about 1,500 new Somali refugees arrive every day. Here's Melissa Fleming again from UNHCR.
Many of the refugees arriving in very bad shape. We're saying it's close to catastrophic. Our nutrition experts are calling it a dire nutritional emergency.
And along with malnutrition, inevitably comes disease. The World Health Organization says that the number of reported cases of suspected measles in Mogadishu has continued to increase at an alarming rate. Since January, there have been an estimated 50,000 cases of acute watery diarrhea or cholera. However, the WHO says that it's confident that aid agencies will be able to prevent a cholera epidemic. Nikki Chadwick, United Nations.
And thank you very much to FSRN for bringing us that story.
And now we're going to bring you a segment on youth theater in Vancouver, which is putting on a slightly, I would say, risque production of...
A classic with a twist, I'd say.
Yeah. The Rocky Horror Picture Show. And now we're joined by the producing and the head director of this play.
Hi there. I'm Deacon Jones. So I am the producer and head director of the Rocky Horror Show, and I also run the Dapper Jumpsuit Productions Youth Theater Society, which is the society that's producing the show. So we are based here in Vancouver, and we're a brand new society. We were just founded this year, actually, in March of 2011. And basically, what we do is we provide youth with the opportunity to develop and enhance their acting, directing, and technical theater skills in a professional and friendly environment, and then let them showcase their skills in a professional performance venue. So this year, as our glorious host just said, we're doing the Rocky Horror Show, which is, I'm sure many of our listeners here know of the show. It's, you know, very famous by Richard O'Brien, written in 1973. The movie version of it, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, came out in 1975. So we've got a cast of about 25 youth actors who are all going to be coming out and performing. It's going to be at the Norman Rothstein Theater. That is on 41st and Oak, and it's going to be on August 18th, 19th, and 20th. It's going to be a really good show.
So it's... Are there students the ones who are going to be acting in this?
Well, we've got a combination. We've got some UBC students, and our main ages are 13 to 20. So it's all youth actors. Both we've got high school students and university students, as well as university students helping on the production team as well. And actually, standing next to me right now here in studio, I've got Avery. He's our props master, so Avery's been helping us out with everything props related, and from getting us a free wheelchair, which we've enjoyed the use of greatly.
Just please don't break it.
We try.
Well, judging from the movie, at least, you must have your hands full with the prop mastery.
Oh, yes. Whips, tight, you know, pantyhose, etc. You can imagine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was actually a show before it was a movie. I did not know this.
It was originally actually a stage show. Started off in England, actually. Richard O'Brien is an English stage and film actor, so he wrote it for the stage, and then it went to film. And the film actually coincidentally starred pretty much all of the original show cast. We had like Tim Curry was in it in the play, Richard O'Brien, Patricia Quinn. I think the only difference was Susan Sarandon.
Did you, working with youth, did you face any challenges working on such a controversial piece, I guess, something so risque with such a young crew?
Well, we made sure that the parents of the youth were informed of the content of the musical before we began. Most of these kids' parents grew up with Rocky Horror, so they know a lot about it, and so, you know, they're, you know, very aware. But for the ones that didn't, you know, we made sure that they were very clear and that they knew what our programming's about. As for our audience members, I mean, we haven't heard anything. I did get an email originally from a gentleman in the theater community a long time ago, cautioning us on our use of the show. But other than that, we haven't really gone completely public with the show yet. Mm-hmm. So I expect that the controversy that will probably arise will come up once we really go, you know, full throttle on the. advertising.
Well, I hope
you just have gone completely public with the show.
CITR, right?
I hope there aren't any very surprised grandmothers in the audience when you first begin this.
Fingers crossed. Yeah. Fingers crossed, for sure. We don't want any... I mean, we have, for a disclaimer, for clarification, we have dulled it down a little, you know, remote... costume-wise, and you know, we've changed some of the actions a little bit because, I mean, you know, we can't have you know, a 16, 17-year-old, I think our Janet's actually 18, running around wearing a bra and panties and nothing else.
Are there many differences between the stage play and the picture show?
There are some. For example, in the picture show, Rocky doesn't talk. In the play, he does. And actually, I found this out recently, an interesting little side note, that Rocky, the reason Rocky didn't talk was because he wasn't actually an actor, he was an underwear model.
Hmm. So he just did what he did best. He stood there and...
didn't model his gold underwear.
Yeah. Is yours an adaptation of the show or the movie?
It's not, it's neither, it is just the show.
It's a hybrid.
well, no, it's an adaptation, I mean, adaptations, and we're using the original script, so it is the original stage show.
And when does it start again?
August 18th, and it runs to the 20th. We will have a show on the Thursday, which is the 18th, at 7:30, Friday at 7:30, Saturday at 2:30, and then at 7:30 as well.
Where can people get their tickets?
People can find our tickets. We are just getting them printed now, so they will be available online within the week at www.dapperjumpsuit, that's DAPPERJUMPSUIT.com/tickets. Or you can buy them at the door. You can also phone us for any more ticketing information at 778-877-8662.
All right, thanks a lot, Deacon.
Thank you.
We're going to take a second here. You're listening to CITR News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
For 7 days in July, Vancouver will play host to another international gathering of sports enthusiasts as we host the North American Out Games. The Out Games will feature 18 different sports, from badminton to poker to hockey. The games will also include the Human Rights Conference, with workshops on diversity and an awards ceremony recognizing individuals and corporations that have influenced LGBTQ rights. Scheduled events during week-long games include a job fair, the Miss Gay and Lesbian Sports Association pageant, cultural activities, and the most amazing closing ceremonies you've ever laid witness to. The event will come to a close with a march of athletes in the world-famous 2011 Vancouver Pride Parade. Catch all the festivities, events, and parties at www.vancouver2011outgames.com. Listen to our live broadcast on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver, or check out our live stream at www.citr.ca and www.queerfmvancouver.com.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to News 101. I'm Iqbal Ahmed and...
I'm Martin Lemlin. We're now going to give things over to FSRN once again for a special report they did on Tel Aviv, where tens of thousands of Israelis took to the streets this weekend to protest the rising cost of living.
Over the weekend, tens of thousands of Israelis poured onto the streets in Tel Aviv to protest the rising cost of commodities, housing prices, and stagnation in salaries. The Real News Network's Leah Tarachansky reports.
On Saturday night, tens of thousands of young Israelis poured onto the streets of Tel Aviv in one of the biggest demonstrations in recent years. The protest was a culmination of dozens of actions against the rising prices of commodities, rent, and the stagnation in wages.
We work hard, our salaries are reasonable, and yet it's not even on our horizon to buy an apartment in this country. It's not logical.
2 weeks ago, a spontaneous tent city was erected in one of the richest neighborhoods of Tel Aviv. In the days following, the number of tents multiplied and tent cities sprung up throughout the country. Anonymous activists organized direct actions in various cities against banks, municipal buildings, and grocers.
בזמן שהממשלה מעדיפה בעלי הון, בנקים, היא לא בונה
יוקרה ונותנת הקלות במס לבעלי הון.
התשובה לממשלה, מהפכה!
העם רוצה צדק חברתי!
Netanyahu הוא אבי השיטה. נתניהו הוא זה שאילץ, למשל...
Netanyahu is the one who made it possible. He's the one who forced, for example, he forced the institutions, the savings funds, the pension funds to invest in the market, and the funds of Yitzhak Tshuva, Ben Dov, and other oligarchs. Netanyahu is the one who systemically destroyed our social services, and he's the one who's now trying to destroy the electricity company. The price of electricity is expected to rise in coming weeks by 20% to 25%. The reason is that the Ministry of Finance taxes a ton of diesel, $970, but only $4 for a ton of fuel oil, when it knows the electric company isn't allowed to use fuel oil. The purpose is to break the electrical company that has a strong union and to privatize it.
The demonstration received such wide coverage throughout Israel that the next day, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu decided to respond.
We will do two major things this week. We will pass reforms in the committees of construction and planning, and secondly, we will identify specific targeted steps with the purpose of helping young couples and students and other communities in need.
In historical times, there was public housing in Israel, and when the Likud came to power, they stopped all these programs, including after selling the public housing to the residents, they stopped all building of new public housing. The Prime Minister had started this in his economic policy for years. When Member of Parliament Ran Cohen has made the law of public housing, it was the Prime Minister Netanyahu that stopped through the Esderim law, going by this law, and ever since Netanyahu is in power, you can see the social policy going to a capitalist most without any stops.
That was Yoav Goldring, chair of Tel Aviv Jaffa's Municipal Oversight Committee, speaking at a rally in Tel Aviv on Saturday in which tens of thousands protested government policies on housing, commodities and unemployment. That segment was produced by the Real News Network's Leah Tarachansky, who reports that the demonstration ended when police on horseback rode into a crowd of protesters. At least one woman was seriously injured and nearly 40 demonstrators arrested. To hear Leah's story on Israeli authorities evicting one of the tent cities set up by protesters, go to therealnews.com.
Thanks again to FSRN for helping us out there. That's going to do it for our show today on July 20th.